session. The Honorable Chief Justice Annette Kingsley Wheeler presiding, your silence is commanded.
All right. Please be seated. Good morning. We are here for oral argument this morning, but we have two school groups with us. Sun Prairie East High School, if you could please stand. It's nice to have you here with us. Hope you enjoy it. And I understand you're going to stay and meet with Justice Hagedorn today after the second oral argument if time permits. Good. Well, welcome. Nice to have you here. Go ahead and have a seat. And second, Loyal Middle School from Clark County. Wow. Good group. This is a great way to fill the courtroom. So super nice to have you here as well. And Justice Hagedorn, if time permits, we'll meet with you over the noon hour, too. I would urge you all to think of some really tough questions for him. He's pretty smart.
He does.
Okay. All right. Go ahead and have a seat. Nice to have you here. The case that we're hearing this morning is Winnebago County versus DEW. It's 23 AP 215. Could I start with your appearances? All right, good morning to both of you. Lineup is 25 minutes, 30 minutes, 5 minutes in rebuttal, right? Okay, let's go.
Good morning, and may it please the court. I'd like to start our discussion today with Outagamie County versus Melanie L. In that case, this court analyzed our involuntary medication statute and emphasized three important components which function to protect the rights of individuals. Number one, such hearings cannot be perfunctory, and in fact, this court specifically cautioned county petitioners that they could not take the prospect of judicial approval for granted. Number two, there is a presumption of competency, which applies regardless of the person's mental health history or their commitment status. And most importantly, for the purposes of this case, number three, it's the county that has the burden of overcoming that presumption by clear and convincing evidence with respect to each statutory element. I'm here today with a relatively straightforward ask, and that is that this court simply reaffirm and apply what it stated in Melanie L. The county, for its part, is here to make a different request. It is asking this court to do exactly what the court said it could not do in Melanie L., which is to rewrite the statute to make the county's task easier at future medication hearings. The county seeks a holding, which will leave no room in our common law for Melanie L., which will undermine the statutory scheme set forth by our legislature, which will fail to protect the rights of individuals, and will transform our circuit court judges into mere bureaucratic agents whose task is to simply rubber stamp the proposed orders.
Counsel, do you think Do you think that Melanie L. requires something other than or more than the statute?
So I think that Melanie L., when we look at Justice Prosser's analysis, it's a very close textual reading. We see Justice Prosser going section, clause, phrase by phrase of the statute. I think the analysis adheres very tightly to the statute and simply seeks to explain and apply how that statute should be applied at these hearings.
So a lot of your argument seemed to focus on some of the language and, you know, what some might look at as kind of, you know, best practices and how things might operate. You know, I'm wondering if you're asking us to, like, pay more attention. Like, can we just follow what the statute says and focus on the statutory language without reference to Melanie L., or do you think Melanie L. says we need to do something else or something, some sort of higher level of detail than the statute specifies?
So I think Melanie L. is simply applying the statute. I think when we look with the statutory text, and I think you're absolutely right that the statutory text is where we should start our analysis. And when we look at this statute, I think it's important to see how this statute functions. And the explanation requirement, which I think is one of the main controverted issues in this case, is a good example of how looking at the statute is helpful, right? So when we look at sub 3 of the statute, it tells us that an individual like DEW has a right to It tells us that that right applies unless the court finds under sub 4 that he's incompetent. When we then go look at sub 4, it tells us in detail what has to happen in order for that very important right to be overcome, right? This is a significant intrusion. The court has been very clear in Virgil D., Melanie L., many of the other cases. This is a very significant ask from a state actor. And so it tells us in very clear terms, starting with the introductory language of sub 4, it tells us that before we even get to a determination of incapacity under A or B, there is that necessary prerequisite under sub 4 that the county provide an explanation of the advantages, disadvantages, and alternatives to the particular medication it seeks to administer. And this is extremely important statutory language because, again, under sub 3, that person has a right to exercise informed consent. So what the statute begins by telling us is, county, before you seek to involuntarily administer, you seek to have a court override this person's bodily autonomy, you need to provide that person with that information.
So you just talked about the particular medication. So say the doctors would determine that the medication should be changed. Do they have to come back to court every time?
So I think under the in order to obtain the order, they need to provide that person the informed consent, the disclosures in the statute, which is they need to provide the particular medication at issue. I don't believe that there is a requirement that they come back to court for a future modification, but at least for the initial order to involuntarily administer the medication, they need to explain to the person what they seek to do, the advantages, disadvantages, and alternatives.
So is it enough that that's done in the report and that the report is in the record? Or does the doctor, in your opinion, have to actually testify as to which medication, like name it, during the hearing?
So I think, as we've seen in other 51 cases, I think it's pretty clear at this point that doctor's reports, if they're admitted into the record, which in this case the doctor's report was not admitted, so it's not part of what the court was considering, that those reports can be useful pieces of evidence. And certainly I think if the doctor's report contains sufficient information in there for the court to make the necessary determination under sub 4, again, Virgil D. tells us that the court must first be satisfied that the explanation has occurred. If there's sufficient information in that report which would enable that judicial finding, I think the report is...
When you say it wasn't...
I was going to ask that same question. Go ahead.
I just want to zero in on when you talk about the court not being admitted. In these cases, the court orders the examination. It's not done on behalf of one of the parties, correct? And the report is then sent to the court.
That's correct.
So it's a little different than a party trying to move in a report as evidence that was created on behalf of the party. This is what the court asked for. The court ordered. It goes into the court file, and all the parties have access to it. So are you saying that it's already part of the record? It's part of what the court has. Are you saying that because one of the parties does not say, Judge, this report that you ordered, this report that was sent to you, this report that's in your file, this report that went to all the parties, this report that we all have access to, that someone has to say, I'd like to now move that into evidence. Please accept this into evidence?
So I certainly think that's what the current state of the law would support. I think when we look at how the Court of Appeals has addressed the issue of doctors' reports in the 51 context, when we look at Outagamie County versus LXDO, the courts recognize that there are some circumstances where that report is kind of automatically in the record, but there are other circumstances where it has to be affirmatively moved into the record. For the purposes of a medication hearing, the county, if it wants the court to specifically consider that, it needs to move that into the record. I don't think it's sufficient merely that it's part of the quote-unquote court record because it's been filed in the course of the case. If it's going to be evidence at the hearing, it needs to be admitted and moved into the record at that hearing.
Counsel, assume that the order for the hearing and order for involuntary medication and treatment was divorced, not the hearing itself, but the order for involuntary medication and treatment was divorced from the order of commitment extension. By that I mean in the hypothetical, that you have the extension order that did not order the involuntary administration of psychotropic medication. But as the order continues for recommitment, it's clear that this person needs, or it appears that the person needs to be subject to an involuntary administration of that medication. Is there any case law that you can point to that indicates that in a hearing for the involuntary medication and treatment that the court-ordered form, which is, of course, part of the record, cannot be relied upon?
So I don't believe that we have a clear-cut case specifically addressing that proposition as to that, specifically with report to a medication hearing. Again, I think we have LXDO, which indicates that those reports are not automatically, quote-unquote, part of the record. I certainly think that that is persuasive authority in terms of looking at this issue. But I'd note that even if we're going to consider this report as part of what was before the circuit court judge, which again I don't think is strictly proper, but even if we're going to consider that, I still don't think that the report in this case has sufficient information which would enable the court to find by clear and convincing evidence that all elements of the county's case had been proven.
Okay. So just
even if we have the report. I'm sorry. I just want to make sure I heard him. Even with the report, if we have the report, it's still not enough.
So in this case, with respect to this report, I don't think that this report is sufficient. Certainly, if we're just looking at the medication issue, the particular medication issue, I'm talking about the general finding of the overall finding that there was sufficient evidence to involuntarily administer medication. I would concede that the report, with respect to the particular medication issue, it does name two medications in that report. That might be enough, but again, I'd note that the report is not super clear. I guess there's an inference that you could potentially make that those medications were discussed with DEW, but the report simply states those are the medications that he's been prescribed, not necessarily that those were the medications that the examiner sat down and discussed with him in detail.
Isn't that a reasonable inference when you combine his testimony together with naming these two medications? And as I recall, there was discussion about not wanting to take the one medication, particularly at bedtime. So when you take his testimony and the names of the specific psychotropic medications, aren't there reasonable inferences that these are the medications that are listed, are the ones they were discussing?
I certainly think that that inference exists, but even beyond the particular medication issue, it's not sufficient to merely name the medications. We have to have clear and convincing evidence that the examiner gave, as the Virgil D. Court said, an adequate, as the Melanie L. Court said, a reasonable explanation of those statutorily required elements, the advantages, disadvantages, and alternatives. And as I pointed out in my brief, we don't have very strong evidence with respect to certainly advantages and certainly the disadvantages. I think when we compare this case against, for example, another unpublished but persuasive decision from the Court of Appeals, Milwaukee County versus DH. And in that case, the Court of Appeals analyzed how the person was informed about the medications and found some really concerning shortcomings as to how side effects had been minimized and weren't adequately discussed with the patient. Again, this matters because what the statute is trying to do is provide that person with that opportunity to exercise that informed consent. And
so, counsel, let's talk about that reasonableness and the side effects. And tell me, what do you think we should establish for the circuit courts when it comes to just that? How many side effects need to be discussed with the patient? Many of these drugs that are listed list dozens of side effects. So are you talking about just the main possible side effects or all of them? What do you think the doctor has to do?
So, again, I think that this court has already answered this question to some extent in Virgil D. and, excuse me, in Melanie L., where the court discussed the requirement being an adequate explanation or reasonable explanation. And, again, there's many different psychotropic medications. I think, tried to list how many possibilities there were in my brief. They all have different side effects. There's going to be different evidence in different cases. I think the circuit court can be entrusted to apply that guidance. And again, depending on the context of the specific case, the explanation might look different. But at the very least, under Virgil D. and Melanie L., it needs to be adequate or it needs to be reasonable. And in this case, I think it's very clear that the county was not totally forthcoming with DEW about the serious side effects that were at issue in these medications. And again, I think that that really matters, and I don't think that we should minimize or just kind of speed past that, because what we're talking about is we're talking about a person's right to refuse medication. We're talking about an agent of the state essentially asking for judicial approval to involuntarily administer a substance, which is going to change the way that that person thinks and perceives the world, will have potentially life-altering.
Are you saying all the side effects need to be discussed? I guess I'm not really understanding the response.
I don't think that there is a clear-cut, hard and fast requirement of you need to discuss 10 side effects, 15 side effects, 20 side effects. Again, I think under Virgil D. and Melanie L., the explanation needs to be adequate and it needs to be reasonable. And under those rubrics, in this case, that the explanation clearly falls short because, again, the examiner's testimony was very conclusory, discussed some very generic and general side effects. I believe his testimony was, well, all medications have side effects. That's not sufficient. I mean, when we look at another unpublished but citable case from the Court of Appeals, Waukesha County versus MJS, another decision analyzing this statute. In that case, the Court of Appeals used language such as, this isn't just a magnanimous nicety that the county has to provide. This is an information disclosure that is a necessary prerequisite to involuntarily administering medication to a person who does not want it. And so it is very meaningful that the person receive that adequate or reasonable explanation. And again, when we go back to the text of the statute, it matters because when we look at those incapacity standards under sub A and sub B, what we're talking about, what we're asking the court to analyze is under sub A, did the person understand that information? And under sub B, can the person apply that information? So I think it's difficult to ask a circuit court to answer those two questions if we don't have sufficient evidence as to what information the person is supposed to be understanding or applying.
Counsel, when we're reviewing what the trial court did here or found here, to what extent should we as an appellate court be reading the testimony and coming up with our own interpretation of it? And to what extent should we defer to the trial court's reasonable inferences from the testimony? So, for example, in relation to whether the advantages or disadvantages were communicated to him, He doesn't answer it directly, but trial court sure found that he did, and Court of Appeals, concludes that that's also a reasonable inference, in fact, maybe even a clear inference from that. Your argument is no, it's not, and so it's a little bit of a standard of review question, right? Is it our job to reread it and come up with our own reading of the testimony, or to conclude that the trial court's determinations were a reasonable inference from the record?
So I think as this court set forth in Melanie L., it's a mixed standard of review. Obviously, we're dealing with some factual questions about, what explanation happened, or when did you talk to this person, or what did you discuss with this person. To some extent, those are factual questions. But whether that testimony then satisfies the legal standard is a question of law. And I'd also note in this case, when we're looking at circuit court findings, I'm not here today asking this court to impose a DJW-type analysis for a medication order, but I think it's notable that the circuit court did not do us any favors with its findings. When we look at what the circuit court said with respect to the medication order, essentially what the circuit court said was, well, he's using medication as a tool to get what he wants in prison, so we're going to take that tool away from him. That's completely unresponsive to any statutory criteria and doesn't discuss any of the disputed factual information in the statute.
So let me just to suss out a little bit of what you're saying. So the trial court looks and said, listen, it's pretty clear he did talk about it, and here's generally speaking what he talked about it. Tell me how we as an appellate court are supposed to deal with that mixed standard of review, right? So there's kind of a factual finding of whether advantages and disadvantages were communicated. I suppose maybe there's a legal standard in there as well as to whether it was a sufficient level of advantages and disadvantages to comply with the statute to some extent. But what are we supposed to do on that? Again, I think arguably the Court of Appeals is right. There's pretty clear inference from the record that was communicated to him. You can make an argument against that. I understand it because it wasn't explicitly stated. But how should we think about that?
So I think the side effects is probably the clearest example to explain this, right? So the court's in a position to hear the testimony, and certainly the court could make a finding of, I'm finding that with respect to side effects, a conversation occurred. Now, it's not clear from this record when the conversation occurred, but a conversation occurred, and side effect 1, 2, 3 was communicated to DEW. I think that's a factual finding. Whether that communication is reasonable or adequate under Melanie L. and Virgil D., that's the question of law that the court has to analyze as to whether that is sufficient evidence, whether that's clear and convincing evidence sufficient to meet that very important requirement, that necessary prerequisite to involuntarily administering that medication.
Attorney August, can I take you back to LXDO, which I just quickly read as best I can here? But I see that it relies on SLL for the proposition that because SLL said that only provisions 10 through 13 apply, that therefore it distinguished the idea of having a report that it had to be admitted into evidence because this is a recommitment, and so therefore it falls under sub 9. If we were to take that piece out, is there any other distinction in terms of the way that the way that the report is in the record here that means that the court shouldn't be able to rely on it? I don't know if my question makes sense. Hopefully you can follow me. Did that make any sense?
I think so. So
that's the first question. Did I make
an honest answer?
fact, not an evidence.
You see what I'm getting at? I read the rationale, and if we don't buy that rationale, what exactly is different with how reports are created and how courts rely on them in a commitment versus a recommitment hearing?
So I think even this court in DJW acknowledged that I think reports should be in evidence in order to be considered. LXDO defines something of a very precise exception or narrow reading of DJW in order to create this exception for some reports to be admitted in the 51 context. It's complicated in this case because we're dealing with a joint recommitment slash medication.
Yes, right.
But I think in general, the rule should be, or the rule is, that if the county wants to rely on specific evidence, if it wants the court to address specific evidence, it needs to place that evidence in the record. It needs to move that exhibit in. It needs to ask the examiner about it during testimony and do the types of things that we expect litigants to do in order to support their case.
Counsel, there's no doubt that the report of the doctor is part of the confidential court record. Is that correct?
That's true.
Yeah. So my understanding of your earlier answer to my question is that for the initial commitment, the report does not have to be admitted into evidence. Under LXDO, for recommitment, it does. But for a involuntary administration of psychotropic medication order, the law is is uncertain.
Well, I think that the general proposition remains, I think as this court indicated in DJW, which is if the court is going to consider things as far as making the determination, it needs to be in the record.
Well, look at Christopher S. It doesn't appear to me that that report was in the record. You may recall that one doctor testified and then the majority relied on a report from another doctor that had been filed, and that was part of what the court relied upon in making its determination. So I'm just unsure, and you can cite to no case that says with regard to an involuntary administration order whether or not what is part of the record pursuant to a court order, whether or not the court can consider that.
I see that my red light is on. May I answer?
You may answer that question.
Thank you. My answer to that would be, when this court decided DJW, I thought that the rule was clear, that if you want to consider a report, it needs to be admitted. The Court of Appeals has defined this narrow exception in LXDO with respect to these reports in the commitment context. But I think the general rule and the general thrust of what the court was saying in DJW remains correct.
Thank you.
May it please the court. My name is Catherine Scherer, and I represent Winnebago County. This court should affirm the Court of Appeals decision for the following three reasons. First, the Court of Appeals got it right when it concluded that some particular medication was explained to Darren. Second, we know that the medication explained to Darren was within the group of psychotropic medications because the doctor testified that he wanted authorization to treat with psychotropic medications. And also, just relying on some of the conversation that just occurred, you can also understand that the doctor explained some particular medication if you look at the report that is in the record, and you discussed that a little bit with counsel here.
So on your third, can I just go back to the second part of your second point?
Sure.
Where you talked about it being just, we know that they were talking about psychotropic meds?
Yes.
So you're just saying as long as we know it's in the category of psychotropic medication, that fits the particular standard?
Well, I think we can infer.
There's got to be, how many, there's got to be, you know, many, many, hundreds, if not more, of psychotropic medication,
right,
all with different side effects, all with different advantages and disadvantages.
Right. Well, in the record, the doctor did testify that he was requesting authorization to administer psychotropic medication. And that is what the order authorizes him to do. It does not authorize. It's a general order. It is not specific. And so even though I believe that you can infer that some particular medication, very, very, very likely it was the medications that are listed in the report that is filed with the court. The court is not authorizing the doctor to administer a specific medication. It's general. And that is what the statute authorizes. The court is not authorizing a specific medication.
Well, it says it's a particular medication. How do you square that?
I'm sorry?
The statute said it's a particular medication. How do you square that?
It does. It does say that the doctor is supposed to explain the advantages, disadvantages, and alternatives of the particular medication. And in this case, in the record, or at least in the hearing, the doctor did not name that specific medication. But we know that the doctor did explain some particular medication, and it's likely that it was the medications that are listed in the report. But that specific question was not asked. And so when the court is reviewing a case for sufficiency of the evidence, you are allowed to make reasonable inferences from the credible testimony. You're allowed to search the entire record. And it's a search for the truth. And if you look at the record, the physical record, you have the report. And in the report, the doctor says that Darren was being offered paliperidone, which is an antipsychotic, and Cogentin, which is a medication.
So those are in the report. Your friend on the other side says, hold on. Mm-hmm. The county never moved the report into evidence. So although it's part of the official court record, it was never moved into evidence. What
correct
about that?
Well, I think in that kind of a case, the circuit court as well as the reviewing courts can consider what the credible testimony was from the doctor and apply reasonable inferences to conclude that some particular medication was explained.
So if we don't use the report, you think you still have that it's still been established that some particular medication has been explained?
I do. I do.
Because I think if we're not looking at the report, that's enough just to say.
Well, I do respectfully because the doctor testified he's requesting authorization to treat with psychotropic medication. This is an individual who has schizoaffective disorder, which is a substantial disorder of thought, and it grossly impairs his ability to recognize reality. It affects his behavior, and in fact, in 2017, while he was unmedicated and out of his mind, he killed someone with a baseball bat.
I want to drill down on the report and what your position is on the report of the doctor in this case. Your friend on the other side says we are not to, even though it's part of the record, it didn't get moved into evidence. What's your position on that report?
Well, I think I'm glad to hear that the court is considering this because I think that the court should extend the holding in LXDO, which had specifically to commitment cases, and it allowed the court to consider the report even if it wasn't entered into evidence. But if it was part of the court record, on initial commitment cases, thank you. But for recommitment cases, and we're really only talking about the medication order here in this case, and as Justice Bradley pointed out, there is no case law on that applying it to here. But I think that would be extremely helpful for the court, for the circuit court and appellate courts, search for the truth in these cases. You would still need testimony that would meet your burden of proof. The county wouldn't just come in and say, you know, Your Honor, I would ask that you just rely on the court, on the report. You would still need to present testimony. You would need to present your expert and establish his experience and his expertise and what he did in the evaluation to flesh out more of the report. The report is, as you noted, is a court form, and it addresses, and it was specifically designed by the our Wisconsin court system to address all of those statutory standards that are required. And that is, and that's critical, because what is the court's role to do? What does the court need to do? They need to consider, do the facts satisfy the legal standards? And in Melanie L., the court said that medical experts, their testimony needs to relate back and rely on the statutory standards. So the court report form is helpful for the courts, for the parties, to make sure that there is a full record of that the statutory standards are met. But that's only one piece. That would be one piece of the whole case. There would be testimony as well, as I mentioned. And in our case, I believe that there is sufficient evidence to establish that there was a reasonable explanation and that, in fact, Darren was incompetent to refuse. The doctor did not state the medication, the name, and that's unfortunate. But the rest of his testimony, after he is asked if he was requesting authorization to involuntarily medicate Darren with psychotropic medication, all the rest of the testimony relates back to that statement that he's requesting authorization for that general group of medications. And I would just point to the transcript as follows. Question, and would that medication have therapeutic value for him? Yes. Question, would it unreasonably impair his ability to prepare for future court hearings? Answer, no. Again, it should help him to do so. In your medical opinion, is Darren competent to refuse medication at the moment? Answer, no. All of those questions regarding medication relate back to that request to authorize for psychotropic medication.
And they relate back to the report, right? But what I hear you asking us to do is to say that it's to hold, that it's enough to just say it's a general group of medications. And that's a little concerning with that word particular.
Well, particular could mean the specific medication, Your Honor, but I also think, given the definition of particular, it could also mean a group of things.
Under what definition would particular mean a group?
From Merriam-Webster's dictionary, Your Honor. I couldn't find one in the case law, so I looked one up. And let me locate that. So Merriam's Merriam Dictionary does define, particular as used to single out an individual member of a specified group or class. Psychotropic medications are a group of medications in general. Of course, in this case, we're not talking about, you know, treating cancer or anything else but a psychiatric condition, schizoaffective disorder, which is treated with antipsychotics, which fall within that class.
But that group of medications, you understand, the individual medications have differing side effects.
Yes.
So isn't it important for a patient to understand which medication he's going to be given potentially so that he can evaluate whether he wants to take the medication based on those side effects?
Absolutely. And in this case, Your Honor, I do believe that Darren was provided an explanation of, I say some particular medication, but it's the particular medication that's listed in the report, the paliperidone, which is an antipsychotic that treats individual that's intended to treat Darren for his schizoaffective disorder. So,
and I don't disagree with you. That's how I read the record as well, but I understood your argument to be suggesting that a patient does not need to be told the particular medication.
Oh, no. I do believe he does need to be told.
Thank you.
Yes, yes. But I think it's clear from the testimony, if you're trying to, because unfortunately the doctor didn't testify to the name of the medication, and all we have is his request, the general request to authorize psychotropic medications.
And well, was the doctor asked the question?
I'm sorry?
Was the doctor asked that question?
He was not asked that question. No, he was not. But he was asked, Doctor, are you asking, or did you advise Darren of the advantages, disadvantages, and alternatives to the medication? And will you cite one or more of the advantages? And the doctor did that. And I believe that from the record, you can infer from the credible testimony of the psychiatrist that those advantages are the advantages of the particular medication that he explained to him back at the WRC when he was trying for almost 2 months to get him to take the medication to treat his schizoaffective disorder. And he also covered with him the disadvantages. He also explained to him the alternatives. And an important point in this case, Your Honor, as was pointed out in Christopher S., is that during this medication hearing, all of this testimony was being given, and the statutory standards were being respected and discussed. There was no challenge, except for two objections from Darren's attorney that were overruled. There was no objection to any of the testimony. There was no cross-examination on any of the elements that supported the medication order. The only cross-examination that occurred was about the least restrictive placement because, as we know, these are combined hearings. So
why does all that matter? It's the burden of the county. The defense doesn't have to say anything, and frankly, if the county doesn't show it, they're better off not asking any questions, right?
You're right.
You might get the information out of the doctor that the county didn't get out. So
you're right. The county does have the burden of proof, but the burden of proof in this case is not beyond a reasonable doubt. It is clear, satisfactory, and convincing evidence. And juries, when they are sitting on these cases and other cases that apply this middle burden of proof, juries are, and the courts follow this as well, of course, they are instructed that clear, satisfactory, and convincing evidence is evidence when compared against the evidence opposed to it has more convincing power. So the reason I say, and I think the reason that it's important and that the court and Christopher S. pointed this out, is that there was no evidence opposed to the county's case. None. I think the county met its burden of proof of clear and convincing evidence on all the elements. Yes, you do have to make some reasonable inferences, but that is what the courts do every day, day in and day out. And one analogy I want to make here is because the particular medication was not named, I don't think that that should be fatal, and I would hope that if this court finds that the evidence was insufficient, that it would not make a per se rule, as Darren suggests that this court should make, and here's why. So if the county did not present that evidence, my analogy is to a battery case, basically. And in a battery case, as you know, you have to prove that the victim did not consent to being punched. So, for example, the case might present itself as a woman was punched in the face several times. She's screaming out for help. She's injured. She has pain. But the count or the state never asked her, did you consent to that? Would that be fatal to our case, to the state's case? Would defense be successful in a directed verdict? Of course not, because the court can reasonably infer that she didn't consent. And yes, that without consent is an element, but the court could still, or a jury could still find that she didn't consent because you're looking at all the information, the credible testimony as a whole. Just like in a guardianship case.
Counsel, before you get to the guardianship case, I want to get a question in. And that is, part of my job is to worry about a number of things, including unintended consequences of our decisions. If opposing counsel prevails, what's the retroactive consequence? If your opposing counsel prevails, how, if at all, does it affect other hearings that may be the same or even less sufficient than the transcript shows here? Is there any consequence of those being void or being because of not meeting standard? Maybe not. So tell me, because I'd like to check it off and stop worrying about that.
Well, I believe, is your question whether there will be a retrospective? Okay.
Yes.
I don't believe, unless the court specifically says that this is going to apply retrospectively, it should only apply prospectively. So from whenever your decision comes out from that day forward, just like DJW when you decided that in the spring of 2020, that was only applied to cases that came before the court and that were heard in the circuit courts after that date. So I would hope you would not apply it retrospectively.
I don't think we would say we apply this retrospectively, but I'm wondering if the law, since we're dealing with liberty interests, there's no problem.
Your Honor, I think one way to address that problem is individuals can always come back to the court to have the court review their medication order. So Darren, if his order expired in October, but if his order was still open, he could come back to the circuit court and have the court review his medication order, and it could be handled that way. That's how I would.
Are you arguing mootness at all?
I am, Your Honor. I know that this court took this case after it became moot, but I do believe that that is an important point to raise here because of the flood of appeals that our system is experiencing in these types of cases because of the court's rulings in DK and SAM. But those cases apply to involuntary commitments. Those same rules that the court found, basically finding that all involuntary commitment cases are not moot because of firearms restrictions and potential financial liability, those don't apply in this case. And I believe it was in LXDO where the Court of Appeals specifically said that involuntary medication orders do not, collateral consequences do not attach to those orders like they do to commitment orders. So I do believe that it is an issue. But Darren did not explain how one of the exceptions to the mootness doctrine apply. So I believe that this court, it would be within your right to dismiss the case as moot.
When we took the case, it wasn't moot. The order was in effect. You're saying it became moot because it expired in October. I don't remember when we took the case.
You took the case in December.
Okay. So you're saying we took it after it was already moot.
Yes.
But what about the situation since these orders are so short? What about a situation where let's say we had taken it in September? Does that change your argument? It still expired.
Wouldn't it need to meet a mootness exception?
It would need to meet a mootness exception.
So you still would argue that it's moot?
Yes, I would.
Even if we took the case and during the time in which it took to brief it and get it here, the order expired?
Well, I think it's one way that the court can dismiss this appeal. I think the court can also affirm the Court of Appeals and the Circuit Court as well because the evidence in this case was sufficient. That's one way. The other way to handle this case is to dismiss it because it is moot. I realize, yes, we've all had done a lot of work to get here to this.
Well, right, and aren't you actually asking us things? Like, what's your best case, your platinum package of what we would say here, if you could have your way about the things we could say that would make things more clear to litigants in these type of cases?
Well, I think the court first should affirm, and I think that the court should clarify for everyone that there is not a per se rule here, that you're not saying that the doctor has to utter advantages or use magic words like the particular medication or the actual medication like paliperidone, which is the medication they were trying to get him to take, and that just reaffirm the standard of review and the court's obligation to assess credibility of the witnesses and apply the credible facts to the statute and to hold the county to the burden of proof, but apply the actual burden of proof. Don't make it harder than it already is.
I heard you also say in there when we were talking about the report that we would maybe clarify whether a report can be relied upon if it's not introduced into evidence.
Thank you. I think that would be an excellent outcome of this. I think that would improve the records in these cases that come before you in the Court of Appeals. That would improve them a lot, and it would clarify a lot of issues that may, for whatever reason, you know, in the heat of trial or whatever it is, some things, just small things like the particular medication, not a small thing, but it's one of many things that the county has to prove, but not to make that omission fatal to the case when everything else is there and you can reasonably make those reasonable inferences. So I would say that would help a great deal if you did that.
Darren argues that you were required to raise the mootness issue in your response to the petition for review. Could you respond to that argument?
I don't believe I was required. At the time, it was not moot. That was in, I believe, maybe, I forget if it was August or September. August, I think. But I don't think I was required at that time to bring it.
Either way, when you said that's your platinum package, it's kind of an interesting phrase as if that's the top tier, I guess, mm-hmm. maybe that. But really, your request is this be dismissed as moot.
Yes, I think, yes, there's two ways, yes. Sufficiency of the evidence and then also mootness. But, again, I recognize that the court accepted this case and you were concerned about these issues and you wanted to hear it even though it had, the case had become moot 2 months prior. So,
if we accept Darren's argument that the doctor didn't explain all of the important side effects, and there is some compelling argument in the brief that there were significant side effects that were omitted from the doctor's conversation with him. If we accept that argument, does it matter if we uphold the finding that he couldn't have understood what the doctor was saying anyway?
Well, first of all, I think in this case, because it was uncontested, an exhaustive amount of side effects that were, if they had been explained to Darren in the examining room, that does not need to come out on the record in the testimony. Of course, the doctors have an obligation to do no harm, and the doctors only purpose is to treat Darren. He has a terrible, you know, mental illness, and he is dangerous. He even killed somebody when he was unmedicated. And yes, going over all those side effects is very important, but that happens in the examining room. Melanie L. doesn't say that has to happen in the courtroom. We have to provide sufficient evidence to meet our burden of proof in the courtroom. But we don't have to have exhaustive information. And I think to answer your question about how that affects whether we proved that he's incompetent under one of those standards, whether he can express or apply an understanding, that's important. And that should be considered, but that's one of many things. And in this case, we know that Darren could not either express or apply an understanding. He thought the medication helped him sleep. He thought he would try to use the medication to bargain more for more food. He never related it to his own illness and the needs that he has to help him not be dangerous and behave in a socially acceptable manner in the WRC. In conclusion, Your Honor, I do believe that this court should affirm the Court of Appeals decision for the following three reasons. First, as I already said, the county presented sufficient evidence, and if the court disagrees and believes that there was insufficient evidence, I would encourage you to limit your holdings to the facts of this case. The court should not adopt a per se rule that doctors must name the medication in the courtroom that was explained to the patient in the examining room. And this court should also not make a broader ruling, as Darren impliedly suggested in his first brief, that trial courts must give doctors specific and not general authorization to treat. This is a general authorization that the doctor, throughout the term of the order, should have the discretion to act on a dime when conditions change, when the side effects may affect the person in a different way. If the court was to make such a ruling, this would impair the county's ability to assure continuity of care and the least restrictive placement and treatment, which is contrary to the legislative intent of Chapter 51. It would also prevent doctors from meeting their ethical obligations to do no harm, because they would not be able to react quickly to the individual patient's needs. It would delay critical treatment to a mentally ill person's changing needs, and it would eventually turn courts and judges into care managers and guardians for people like Darren. That is not the appropriate place for decisions as important as treating someone with schizoaffective disorder. That is not where that should be happening. That should be happening in the examining room with the doctor. And the judges and courts are issuing general authorization only. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. August, as you're making your way up, if you aren't going to do so otherwise, would you please address the mootness issue here?
Certainly. So with respect to mootness, I think when we look at this court's jurisprudence, it's clear that even if an appeal is moot, which I'm not conceding that this is moot, there are those exceptions to mootness which allow the court to resolve the important legal issues at stake. And certainly I filed a petition for review, and I think my petition for review made it very clear to this court, we have instability in our Court of Appeals. I think we also have instability in our circuit courts. We have a situation currently where we have diametrically opposed opinions of the Court of Appeals as to how to apply this court's jurisprudence with respect to involuntary medication orders. And unless this court resolves those issues in this case, what is going to continue to happen is the same petition for review is going to be repeatedly filed, and this issue is going to recur, just as it's recurred since, I think, the 2015 case, Marquette County versus TFW. That's almost a decade ago. On the other end of a spectrum, we have a case like Milwaukee County versus DH. Those two cases are both unpublished, persuasive decisions of the Court of Appeals, both citable, both having diametrically opposed analyses of this question.
And Counsel, do you believe that there are collateral consequences that apply? Do you agree with counsel's representation that the two we have recognized in other contexts, the firearms ban and the cost of care, that those are not applicable in the kind of unique context of this case, which is involuntary med order, which unique to see that on its own, I think, for the most part?
So I think that case law in this area is regrettably somewhat unclear, and this wasn't a primary issue that I think was really briefed extensively in this case, just like the reports issue, which I'd like to get to in a moment. But the only real authority we have on this point is LXDO, which basically tells us this court's work in this area in DK and SAM isn't applicable. And so LXDO, published decision of the Court of Appeals, that's statewide precedential authority. So unfortunately, we can't use this court's opinions in those cases. It goes on to reject some arguments, but in a footnote leaves open for another day additional arguments about mootness. So at this point in time, I don't think that the law is clear as to whether standalone medication orders can be moot or are moot. I think if the court is specifically interested in that question, I would certainly welcome supplemental briefing on that. But again, it's not something that was really extensively briefed or argued in this case. And as I explained in my reply, the reason for that is the timing of this, the appeal, the order expired.
And I get that, but it was a little odd in your response that you didn't address any reason why it wasn't moot. I understand you're relying on the exceptions to mootness, but, you know, published court of appeals decisions don't bind us, and so if a case isn't moot, you know, you could have made that argument in response to your opposing counsel, but you did not. And it's fine if you want to rely on the exceptions. I'm just clarifying that that is the only argument you presented to us at this point.
Well, certainly I don't know that it would have been appropriate to make the totally new argument in the reply, but even beyond that, mm-hmm. quite frankly, I don't know that it matters, because again, I think that this issue needs to be resolved. And if the court doesn't resolve it, as I've indicated, this issue is going to recur in the Court of Appeals because, again, we don't have clarity right now, and we badly need this court to provide that.
One other quick follow-up on a different issue. Your opposing counsel says that the Gerlein was going over the side effects needs to happen in the examining room, not the courtroom. I think that's in some ways a summary of a lot of her position in this case. I'm like, to give you an opportunity to agree to disagree with that and explain why.
So in this this court has on two separate occasions in Virgil D and Melanie L discussed this explanation requirement. In Virgil D, the court was unambiguous that the court needs to be satisfied that an adequate explanation occurred. That's the precedent in the state of Wisconsin. And in Melanie L, the court was very clear that this is an element that needs to be proven by the county. So I think it's problematic to try to just kind of speed past those authorities and essentially take a position which I read as thrust us position, which I think that's problematic, and it's concerning in a way that a lot of the county's arguments are problematic and concerning in this case. Because, again, we're dealing with a very – I'm sorry, I see that my light is on.
Go ahead and finish your statement.
We're dealing with a very significant bodily intrusion. We're dealing with an overcoming of bodily autonomy by state agents. It requires judicial oversight. Thank you.
Thank you. All right. Thank you for oral argument this morning. This case is concluded. We are adjourned. We will be convened for the second oral argument.